Welcome to a late July edition of the VanCast. Always Canucks stuff to talk about on this show. Look, sadly, we do not have Juice again today because we probably could have told stories after last week's episode that was extremely well received, to say the least. We probably could have told another 90 minutes worth of stories. That's the longest VanCast since I've done this show with you.
Oh, that's the longest VanCast ever. But Juice was just so game. He was so good. There was no need to close it. Like, we could have gone all night.
Yeah, we could have. I kind of knew we were going in the wrong direction once he said he was sending my wife naked pictures, or he had done that years and years ago. He told me his wife, Katie, came in right when he said that and said, "Stop that, would you please?" So the wine had gone in a little too deep. But hey, good for Juice. Obviously, we've both known him for a long time and in much different settings than that. And we brought out as much as we could because everything else we probably could have told would just not have met any regulatory standards. Although I know that those things go a lot looser on podcasts than they do on actual radio or television.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. It was a great show. And thanks to Juice for doing it. That was a ton of fun. And we'll try and, well, you know, the guest in the live room thing, despite the technical difficulties, which delayed our start by half an hour, was awesome. And I think we got to try and do that again.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be a lot of fun. And like I said, maybe one day in a year from now, we'll get him back on if he, because we know he's got stories left. But listen, the Vancouver Canucks, Drancer, you know, they haven't had an overly busy offseason, but there have been some important moves. And because we really haven't had a chance to kind of get into the totality of their offseason to this point, we figured this would be a good time to do that. You know, significant moves, where they still need to go, an overall assessment of the roster at this point. If you haven't had a chance to check out the online version of The Athletic, you and Harm put a pretty good article together that was posted late last night. You know, your Canucks offseason 3.0 that just goes through the depth chart again and talks about some of those moves. So we'll get into some of that now. And, you know, as we look at this team and they still need to make some improvements, I mean, did they improve up front? With Mikheyev, sure they did. You know, Curtis Lazar in the bottom six or in the fourth line as a center. Yeah, that's a good move. But we still know, in terms of cap flexibility and prospects and all this stuff aside, the single biggest on-ice decision that needed to be made was improve your top four in the blue line, particularly on your right side. They haven't done that yet. And I think on some levels, they're probably counting on Tucker Poolman to be healthy so that he can help them in that area. But that's still the glaring area of need right now. And they've talked about assessing it via trade. Darren Dreger reported they're still trying to circle back in that area. How realistic is that at this point?
Well, I think it's going to be really hard without cap space. You know, that's the issue, really, that I sort of have generally had, or the concern that I've generally been talking about with the Canucks offseason, which is just, you know, because they've spent the vast majority of their money and their cap is basically committed for next season, you know, it's hard to make deals. If you have cap space, you can acquire John Marino, for example, as the New Jersey Devils did, for a mid-round pick and, you know, a young NHL player who, by the way, hasn't performed very well, right? Like there are teams around the league that would prefer Jack Rathbone to Ty Smith. I'm not saying Jack Rathbone had more trade value. I think Ty Smith had the pedigree and has more NHL experience, but there are definitely teams that would have looked at Rathbone's superior skating and said, yeah, we like that guy better. We see that as a more projectable future NHL piece. So, you know, just goes to show you, right, what you can accomplish with cap space. If you have it, you can buy, you can peruse the clearance bin. Right. If you don't have it, you're paying retail every time. And that's sort of where the Canucks find themselves. You know, it's not impossible that they can find an answer on the blue line between now and the start of the regular season. They still probably have about a million and a bit, million three, million four, something like that in cap flex that you could add to the roster. So you could go out and sign a Calvin DeHaan, for example.
What? You can't get John Klingberg for that amount?
I don't think so. But you also can't just go out and acquire a guy who, you know, you can't do your version of a Pacioretty trade or a Marino trade and just spend in a vacant cap space, because the Canucks, their cap space is spoken for. It's spoken for up front, and it's spoken for with a pair of players that I think are really good fits for how Bruce Boudreaux wants to play and Curtis Lazar and Ilya Mikheyev and how the Canucks want to play and the speed and sandpaper they were looking to add. But, you know, has to be noted, like, these players were both playing bottom six roles, albeit on good teams, but bottom six roles last season. And that's where the Canucks elected to choose their to spend their cap space or invest their cap space. And, you know, I don't know. I would say I'm not ready to carve the decision. I like both players. I think the fits are good. But I don't know if it was a higher leverage area for the Canucks to upgrade than the defense. I mean, I just think that defense has, there's a real chance that it holds them back in a meaningful way next season. And you know, that concerns me.
When you look at the decision to bring in Mikheyev, and look, I think we like the signing in terms of his overall skill set. We're not necessarily sold on the signings because you still will have a offensive expectation when you get 4.75, whether he's shown that prior to last season or not. You can't score, you know, 13 goals and be considered good value no matter how fast you are and what else you do from a two-way perspective. So we're a little nervous about that. But overall, I think both of us agree that when you look at it on the relative need scale, that probably wasn't it. But does that provide an indication of just how difficult they believe it's going to be to improve their back end, even via trade, in a meaningful way that they said, look, let's just spend it elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a recognition that a lot of what the Canucks need to accomplish in the big picture, you know, is a longer term project, right? I think partly what we're seeing too, Farhan, is an indication of just how, like, and look, we talked about this. We talked about this a lot last year, that the decisions that the Canucks had made to construct their roster, right, resulted in them building a team that was going to be difficult to disassemble, right? That the flexibility that the club had was limited, right? We talked about that a lot, that a lot of the moves made were going to be intractable. And I think we saw that play out, right? Like, it's not easy to change this team, period, because of the amount of cap committed and the length of the deals and the quality of the players that are signed to those contracts. And I think that's what they came up against, truly. Like, I think at the end of the day, they came up against, you know, low valuations, big deals to move. And I think it was harder to conduct business than they would have liked to, or certainly the type of business that they wanted to conduct. And so here we are. They're still waiting. This is definitely going to be a multi-year project to renovate this blue line. It might be a 5-year project, to be totally honest with you, to get it to where they really want it. Well, I mean, you've got 2 years left on Myers. You've got 3 years left on Pullman. You've got 5 years left on Ekman-Larsson. You know, I mean, this wasn't going to be accomplished in a single summer, right? It wasn't. But, you know, the patience debate is an interesting one, because while I think it's fair to be patient, you know, I would have applauded a really patient, like, steward offseason, you know? And that's not really what the Canucks had, because they did spend considerably on bottom six forwards in a way that I think for Canucks fans, they're like, oh, deja vu all over again. We've seen this organization do this time and time again. They never save cap space. They always spend it on, you know, forwards from good teams, win now guys. And, you know, I can understand why fans are looking at that and thinking, what's going on? What is the plan here? We don't get it. I don't really get it. Honestly, I don't. And so, you know, I just sort of look at the Canucks offseason and I think, hey, you know, they've found some players that I think fit with how they want to play, but it cost a lot and the opportunity cost is high because it limits what they can do elsewhere. You know, I don't love
and what,
that.
So what does that, let's stay with that real quick. What does that say? You know, we talked about the Mikheyev signing and what that says about their ability or inability to move or to acquire along the blue line or to improve along the blue line. What does it say about them up front? Because I think the one concern everyone had coming into free agency is, yeah, you know, if you looked at the overall number, yes, the Canucks had a number they could use to improve. However, that improvement would come at a cost down the road. It has implications on what you can do with JT Miller, maybe what you must do with Connor Garland. How does it impact Elias Pettersson in another 2 years when that contract, the bridge deal, then becomes due, right? And he becomes the player we think he's going to be, you know, a potential top 10 guy that gets paid as such, right? So, you know, how problematic, and again, this is not a shot at the player, but just the number, and every one of these puzzle pieces aren't just puzzle pieces for 22-23. When it's a four-year deal, it affects you beyond, right? So what does it say about what they're going to have to do beyond up front?
I mean, there's a lot to do. Like, there's a lot to do. I still can't figure out, you know, we go through that depth chart exercise. Like, I still can't figure out how these players fit together.
So true.
You know, like, I don't even get how it all fits. And we sort of talked about it a little bit. Like, you know, who does Connor Garland have chemistry with? It didn't really feel like he found natural chemistry with any of Vancouver's top three centermen, right? You know, Besser's the only right winger that I think you're going to be comfortable playing in matchup minutes. Tanner Pearson's probably the only left winger you're going to feel comfortable playing in matchup minutes. So it's not like, you know, the Canucks have good forwards.
You could
forwards.
Play McKayev there, couldn't you?
Oh, sorry, and Mikhaev. Yeah, you 100% you could
okay,
play
Okay, let's
Mikhaev.
Get this right. Are we going to say McKayev or Mikhaev? Because both networks said it completely differently. The TSN guys kept saying McKayev. The other guys kept saying Mikhaev. So which one is it?
It's probably Mikhaev, I think.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
We'll ask him. We'll ask him when he arrives. But the... Anyway, yeah, so you've got two guys on left wing who can play matchup minutes. You've got one guy on right wing. You know, I'm sure they feel like they can play any one of their top three centers in matchup minutes, but other than, you know, I mean, I think it's Horvat, and I think, you know, Pettersson's had some good defensive moments and good defensive results. I think he can be that player. I don't know that he has been that player before, but I think he will be that player. And, you know, JT Miller held down matchup minutes for the club last season and performed okay, but I don't love his... I'd like to see Miller played in a more offensively calibrated role. So, you know, it feels like this team has a lot of on paper talent, and I'm not sure if the pieces fit so that it's more than the sum of its parts, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
and that concerns me too. That concerns me too. You know, I mean, you look at Calgary in the wake of the Gaudreau departure, right? And, you know, the Canucks, you'd hope, can catch Calgary next season based on the fact that they just lost a Hart Trophy candidate and there's massive uncertainty about what happens with Tkachuk. But let's assume that the Tkachuk situation gets sorted and he's back with the team. You know, their top seven forwards would be something like Tkachuk, Mangiapane, Backlund, Coleman, Lindholm, Toffoli, Dubé, right? And, you know, that sounds inferior to what the Canucks will roll out, right? Like, on paper, I think those seven names versus Pettersson, Besser, Horvat, Miller, Garland, Mikhaev, and Pearson, like, I think you'd take Vancouver's group ahead of that on paper, but I don't know that Vancouver has guys who are as defensively reliable or as, like, high-end from a competitive standpoint as Mangiapane, Coleman, Backlund types, you know, Lindholm types, right? I mean, there's, I feel like Vancouver's players might be better. They are better on paper. You think they're more skilled and talented, but are they as good in the areas that translate to wins as Calgary's group? That's like a thing that I've been thinking about a lot when I look through this forward group. And I'm not saying they can't be that, but I need to see that. Like, it's on them to be at that level, in my view.
Can we digress for a quick minute?
Sure.
Before we go to break here, what the hell is going to happen in Calgary with three arbitration cases, including Tkachuk, which was team determined?
Yeah.
I'm trying to wrap my head around how that is going to play out for a team that this year should have contended for the cup.
It's wild. But, you know, I do think the facility is a big problem there. You know, and I think the fact that they don't have a player friendly coach necessarily, right? Daryl Sutter can be crabby behind the scenes.
Yeah, but again, you know, Tkachuk was team elected. That's basically a death sentence.
No, but it's a different type of team elected. It's the second window. So they're not seeking to cut back his salary, right? So the way that when Tkachuk didn't file for arbitration, he essentially set the Flames on a course to have 6 days. 6 days before he was going to accept his qualifying offer, right? He has to accept his qualifying offer by the 22nd of July. So there was a 6-day window for the Flames to, you know, come to terms with him, or he'd take a 1-year deal and be walked to UFA, right? So they were under the gun. And the second club elected arbitration window allows them to kick that can down the road into like mid-July, right? Like buys them like 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks. They cannot reduce his salary. So this is not as aggressive a move as the first one, which we were talking about and which ultimately drove that Besser settlement, right? It's not an aggressive shot across a player's bow in the same way. They're just opening up time to sort through this. That's what they really did here. You know, I'm sure the player is not thrilled, but it's not the same nuclear option. It really is not, from a negotiating and leverage standpoint, relationship management standpoint. This doesn't stand out to me as a nuclear option the same way that we discussed the Besser one as.
How's it going to play out there with all three? Like, I mean, this thing could implode in a hurry.
Well, the Tkachuk thing's crucial. You know, the thing about Calgary is if you end up bumping Andrew Mangiapane onto your top line, you know, not that he's Gaudreau or going to trick anyone into thinking he is Gaudreau, but like if you go Gaudreau, Lindholm, Tkachuk across the top, across your first line, that's still a top five line in the sport probably, right? It's not the best line in the sport like it was with Gaudreau, but I mean, you know, behind the Matthews line, behind the McDavid line, you know, there's a few others, right? Like there's a few lines that you'd like better, but you know, it's still high end, like really high end, really high end in terms of the amount of compete. You know, Mangiapane, I know, doesn't sort of garner that, like he doesn't have the name recognition, but he scored 35 goals last year. Like he's a top line caliber forward. I think they're poised to manage Gaudreau's departure better than people think, so long as they keep Tkachuk. And now it's looking like they won't keep Tkachuk. And if you lose two elite wingers in one offseason, then you're in trouble. Like that changes things considerably. I think that upsets. Right now, I would still say I like Calgary and Vegas at the top of the Pacific. And if Calgary can keep Tkachuk, that's how I'm going to break it down. I'm going to say Vegas and Calgary are, in my opinion, the two best teams in the Pacific. But if they lose Tkachuk, I think Calgary is going to be in real tough to you know, I still think they'll probably be a wild card team, but they'll be in real tough to be one of the top three teams in the Pacific without either of those players.
Meanwhile, every Canuck fan quotes Jerry Seinfeld and says, that's a shame.
Although Vancouver now has the Miller thing, right? And yeah, one thing I would note, I've never heard that Miller feels about Canada the way some people expect that he would, right? I've never heard that. I've never heard that he feels that way about Vancouver. I've always heard that he's got really good close relationships with the other American-born players in Vancouver, in addition to guys like Miller like Horvat and Pearson and Myers. I don't think Gaudreau's departure should alter the paradigm for teams like Vancouver, Toronto, and Montreal, right? Like, I don't think you need to worry too much if you're the Canucks about the example the Gaudreau departure sets for your ability to retain American-born unrestricted free agents. Like, I don't think, you know, Vancouver's facility is completely different. Boudreau and Daryl Sutter have a very different reputation among players, right? There's an awful lot that I don't think is analogous. And so I would caution people from freaking out, whether it's about Miller in Vancouver or Matthews in Toronto, looking at the Gaudreau template and thinking, oh, that's going to happen here. Like, I don't think that's the case for Vancouver with Miller. I certainly don't think it's the case with Toronto and Matthews. I think that was a unique set of circumstances, you know, connected to everything from the coach, you know, the cold prairie town, the league worst facilities. You know, Calgary was in tough in a different way than the Canucks are.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You know, the Gaudreau thing, Drancer, really is a unique one. Because when was the last time we've heard that an American player was dying to get back to the States? And look, we've said this. We talked about this with Juice, right? Not necessarily as it relates to Canada, U.S. specifically, but just...
Juice's Miller is Kessler argument will stick with me for a long time.
No, but it took a while for Kessler to get there, right? And so, you know, my point was, it was kind of like the baseball analogy. Everybody wants to play for the Yankees once, right? Like, they all want to see what it feels like to be in pinstripes and be that guy once. And then after a while, you're like, yeah, maybe this isn't for me. And every American player at some point...
But Kessler signed here, right? I mean, Kessler's a perfect example because he signed the six-year deal.
No, but eventually it wasn't America, Canada. Yeah, the scrutiny was a problem, but it was also where the club was clearly headed. And Kessler didn't want to be part of it in 2014 of getting into a rebuild situation. He wasn't the Sedins, you know, as a grumpy temperament guy, you know, with the rebuild comes a lot of scrutiny, and he wanted to move on from that. He'd had just about enough. So, you know, and you can maybe just say, look, it's the same thing. I mean, the one biggest difference between the two is that in one place they care, and that means a lot of scrutiny of, you know, I don't know if it's simply the care meter or if it's simply, you know, wanting to get back to warmer climates all winter or whatever. I don't know. I think the scrutiny eventually got to him. I'm not sure that has anything to do with this in Matthew Tkachuk's case. Maybe it did in Johnny Gaudreau's case to a point, right? The fact that he actually took meaningfully less to not go back home, even though he said that was the argument, right? Like, when he said family reasons, everyone assumed Northeast, and it didn't happen that way. So it was a lot more than that. Whereas you look at a guy like Matthew Tkachuk, he is wired to deal with any level of scrutiny and say F you right back. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's a guy that's got such thick skin that you wouldn't think that's any kind of a factor right now. If he thought the team was headed in the right direction, if the facilities were there, you know, and when you look at the number of Americans that have come through this team, you didn't look at any of them and feel like they were anxious to get back right out of the gate. It was slightly different circumstances around Kessler, although, like I said, the comparisons aren't that far off in terms of just attitude and approach.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. Look, the Miller thing, I mean, I think at this point, sometimes you have to look at actions rather than words, right? You have to look at actions rather than reports. And for me, the fact that the team has held Miller for this long to this point makes me feel strongly, just because I can't get another, there's no read on this that will suggest to me anything other than that holding Miller to this point in the offseason suggests that the organization's preference, you know, strongly is to re-sign him rather than deal him. Right? I mean, that's the only logical conclusion I think you can reach at this juncture. And so, you know, I wonder if the bet here, and part of the patience that the organization is trying to show, at least as they see it, is, you know, you update the locker room facilities, right? You extend Horvat. You come in, you have a full training camp with Boudreaux, you play center, you're, you know, playing big minutes in all situations. You hope that it's fun. You believe that the management, you know, group can improve internal communication and the player experience, and the Twins are around, and it's a different vibe than it has been in the past. And you bet on your organization, you bet on yourself as a management team to be able to administer this differently enough that you're able to convince him to stay on a deal that makes sense for the team. That to me has to be the bet at this point. Like, nothing else really makes sense to me to explain the club's passive approach in this circumstance.
So you're expecting to see JT Miller resign?
No, I'm expecting to see him at training camp. We'll see if he resigns.
Well, fair enough.
I think the fact is that it'll come down to absolute numbers, right? Like, here's the thing, right? Is from a trade value perspective, Miller's value will not go up between now and the trade deadline. In fact, every day now, we're now in a zone after July 15th or so that every day that passes, JT Miller's trade value probably goes down.
Absolutely.
Because the, it already has, because teams have already, I mean, there's 18 teams within 5 million of the cap, right? I mean, there's fewer and fewer landing spots. There's fewer places that make sense as a trade partner. There's less demand. Matthew Tkachuk might now be on the market, you know, on and on. Go down the list, right? So from a trade value perspective, the goal is to maximize a JT Miller return. The club has played this terribly. And I don't think that Rutherford and Alvin are new on the block. Like, I don't think they're unwise to that. In fact, I know they're not. There's a reason they tried to extend him at the draft, right? There's a reason he's been, you know, caught up in so many rumors, right? Like, they know this. They know this. The fact that they're taking a different tack and the fact that I'm assuming that they're competent tells me a lot, speaks volumes to me about where they think time maybe favors them. And, you know, if you come back, the team performs well for the first time in a few years. The facilities are revamped in a major way, right? Maybe it looks different to a player. Maybe it looks different to a player. And maybe that player doesn't repeat his 99-point pace, right? Maybe all of a sudden his leverage diminishes. Maybe his desire to sign a deal off of, you know, his huge season last year causes him to be a little more willing to compromise before the season gets underway, right? Doesn't want to risk injury, right? Like, if you're being patient and waiting out the trade market, you're incompetent.
That is the thinnest window. That is the thinnest needle they're trying to thread.
Totally.
If that's what they think. Get him to camp, good facility, and we'll get him signed, you know, we'll get him signed early.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that is a narrow needle, buddy.
You're playing chicken. Well, here's the thing though. If you think you can be patient and wait for the trade market to deliver more than it has to this point, you're wrong. You're incompetent. I don't believe that Rutherford and Alvin are incompetent. So I think they must be trying to wait out Miller. That's my logic here. And I don't think that's outrageous.
I think the trade market has pushed them into no other option than to attempt to wait him out and hope for the best.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's true. I mean, I do think Miller's trade value was perhaps a little more complicated than they'd expected. You know?
Yeah, I think so too.
And I mean, I think there were teams that were skeptical for a variety of reasons. And so it goes.
Let's go through the roster or the depth chart, as it were, that you guys put together. Let's start on left wing. And I'll go through all the forward positions before we dive into them one by one. So let's go Tanner Pearson, Mikhaev, whatever we're calling him. We'll find out soon enough. Kuzmenko, Hoglander, and Joshua as the top five in that order. And you said you could flip the top two.
I would probably also switch Dakota Joshua and Sheldon Dries. If I could do this again. So Dries, I would put at left wing because I think at the NHL level anyway, the team views him more as a winger than a center. And I think Dakota Joshua might actually get a shot. Like, I think if Lazar or if there's a center injury, I think Dickinson, Joshua are kind of the next guys up. So Joshua to me, I would probably relist as a center if we could do this again. And Dries, I would list on the wing.
Gotcha. So let's do that for our purposes. So we've got Dries on the wing as the fifth. And then we'll put Joshua in our center group, which includes Elias Pettersson, Horvat, Miller, Lazar, Dickinson, and then center number six ahead of Carlson would be Joshua. Then on the right side, where it's a little thinner, but still certainly some quality in the top three with Besser, Garland, Podkolzin, Lockwood as the fourth, and Klimovich as the fifth. We don't really see as an opening night option. Maybe he gets a couple games later in the year.
Certainly they've got some... I don't think Klimovich should play a single NHL game next year. Like, at the end of the day, by the time the AHL playoffs came around, he was a scratch. And he was a scratch in favor of a defenseman playing right wing. And the coach who made those decisions got promoted. So the organization doesn't think that that was a poor decision, right? Which tells you a lot about where Klimovich is, right? This guy needs to work on his pro awareness. He's got all the tools to be an NHL player, but he was too young to play in the American League last year. I'm sure if the team could take a mulligan and send him to the CHL, they probably would have. And, you know, if he, like, his goal, the organization's goal for this player should be, is an everyday fixture in the top nine and is productive in that role next season. Do not bring him up. He's not ready. He's not ready. The club should sign an additional right wing to provide some additional depth. I guess Dries could be an option there too. But yeah, I mean, Klimovich should not be counted on to play NHL games. The organization should take a patient approach unless he absolutely knocks the door down. The club should leave him in the American League, let him settle in, let him be productive there if he's able to. It might even be too big an ask.
And knowing that Dries is an organizational depth piece, he's not somebody anybody's considering to be an opening night roster fixture, certainly not in the top 12.
He can make a case, man. I think Dries... I like Dries a lot. I think Dries is a player. Dries could surprise you. Dries could surprise you.
Yeah, you'd have to surprise me a lot to be more than a very good depth piece that we see play, you know, 15 games during the season. But with that in mind, if we were to gauge forwards 13, 14, and 15 based on current setup, that would mean guys like Joshua, Dickinson, and Dries would probably be after that if it was today. Right, like
yeah, and Lockwood.
Yeah, okay. I've got him on the right wing as a fourth line guy.
I don't know. I wonder if we'll see. Like, if I was handicapping it today, I'd be like Dickinson left wing, Lazar center, Hoglander right wing. Is my inside track to be
with
the
who is your fourth left winger then?
Yeah, Dickinson.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, with Dickinson. Okay, so
that would be my inside track as of today.
Okay, so then Lockwood is the 13th guy, if it was today, right?
Yeah,
along with Joshua, one of Lockwood, Joshua, or Dries,
and I'd see them try and bring in another. Like, I think they should bring in another guy to try and bump Dickinson to the 13th forward spot.
How do you do that at 2.5 million?
Well, you can easily sign a 750. You could bring in probably you could bring in Alex Chason or Brad Richardson or someone like that.
No. My point is, with Dickinson, given his salary, how reluctant would the club be to make him, put him in a situation where he's not an everyday NHL player?
Oh, I mean, I just don't think you can care. You can't afford to care. You know, Dickinson should be treated like a 750K guy. He's coming to compete. And you're hopeful that he delivers to some extent on his salary, but that ship has sailed based on his first season in Vancouver.
Yeah, see, for me, I would try to reclaim that value and do everything you could to make him an everyday player.
Well, they will, but you can't shoehorn it in. He needs to knock that door down now, like he does. And because at the end of the day, too, if he's reassigned, then you have two. If you want to go out and sign a $2.4 million piece with the plan to waive Dickinson, you could do that without clearing cap space. Like, you can sign a $2.5 million player responsibly today if your plan is to reassign Jason Dickinson. Well, there's value there. There's value in it. You know,
then you've got to commit to that decision for a full year.
For sure. And I'm not willing to do that, but would I bring in a PTO guy and keep my eye on him? You know, like if a Calvin DeHaan remains unsigned, or, I mean, I don't know, there's so much talent left on the free agent market, but like, you know, let me like think about who's an unrestricted free agent who might cost $2 million. Calvin DeHaan is sort of like my clubhouse leader right now, because he can play the right side on defense. But, you know, if it's a Michael Kempney or a Robert Hagg type, you know, maybe Chris Russell, like, I'd bring a guy like that to training camp, and I'd make Dickinson show me. Maybe Tyler Mott. Hell, Tyler Mott. I'd bring a guy like that to training camp if they remained unsigned, which feels likely considering all the talent available still on the market. I'd bring a guy like that to camp, and I'd make Dickinson show me that he deserves to be in the lineup. And if he can't do that, then I'd sign a guy.
Incredible. Tyler Mott still available.
Incredible. Danton Heinen's another one who would sort of meet my specifications here. But you see what I'm saying? Like, a guy who's not going to sign a vet minimum deal necessarily, or a guy who wants to audition for a larger role, like, you could bring that guy to camp and make your decision based off of the cap flexibility that you have with Dickinson. You just keep the player in the loop, right? I mean, there's guys I think that would warrant that type of risk. PK
Subban. Is there a world where you could keep a portion of Dickinson's salary and trade him to Rick Bonus in Winnipeg, who he had his greatest successes under?
Maybe if you take money back, but you'd have to take money back. And so,
no, that's what I said. Like, if you could keep a portion of his salary.
Yeah, but then also take, but you'd have to do both, though, I think.
Really?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's, look, you have to pay to get off of Max Pacioretty, man. You know?
Yeah, like, I guess so, but like, you take $600,000 of that salary. You have
to take 25 cents on the dollar to acquire John Marino.
Yeah, that's different.
Like, that's the world now. That's just the world that teams live in. So yeah, I mean, I don't know, Winnipeg doesn't have like a ton of bad salary, but maybe if they want to move some money off of their defense core, I guess, I don't know. I just don't see where the money that Winnipeg would want to send out is. They have $14 million in cap space with Dubois and Appleton still to do. I mean, sure. Maybe, look, if Rick Bonus was interested and you retain half, I mean, I'd consider that for sure.
Real quick, I do want to touch on the defense because I know we're going to make this episode a little bit shorter, but Tucker Poolman, where are we at on him? I mean, I read what you guys wrote, that there's still a lot of optimism, but if he's healthy and available and capable, is he instantly your second right winger or your second right D, I should say?
No, I don't think so. I want to see... I think you still roll. I mean, it's tough. Like, I don't know. I don't exactly know how this all fits. I wonder if you might see something like Hughes, Ekman, Larson, Dermott, Myers, and then Jack Rathbone and or Kyle Burrows with Tucker Poolman. Right. I wonder if we'd see something like that or could see something like that. I mean, I think the fact is that there's no right answer. You know, Tucker Poolman, we know, doesn't really work with Quinn Hughes. I think Tucker Pullman's a really good defensive piece, but his puck handling makes him something of like he takes a few things off the table offensively. And we saw it a lot with Hughes. Like, Hughes needs you to be able to maintain possession at a level that I don't know that Pullman's really capable of. So I think it's a bad fit, even though in your mind's eye, mobile defense first righty, perfect for Quinn. You know, I just don't know that Pullman's puck handling's quite at that level. I just don't think that it's a good fit. It wasn't a good fit early in the season. And I like Pullman's game a lot better when you move further down the defense, you know, depth chart. I think I like the idea of a Dermott Pullman third pair. I like the idea of Poolman with Rathbone. I don't hate the idea of him playing with Ekman Larson. And maybe you go Myers Rathbone with obviously Myers playing more minutes than that third pair assignment suggests, right? You can tweak things as the game goes on, depending on the score. Those would be sort of formulations that I like. Poolman Hughes, Poolman is top four guy. You know, I'm okay with it if it's with Ekman Larson in a shutdown role. I don't like it when Poolman runs as a caddy for Hughes.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it before, and it, like, my gut still tells me they're going to wind up with Luke Shen there for large minutes of the season, but we'll see.
Agreed.
We'll see where it goes. Listen, it is time for us to run. Sure, you know, it's a summertime, so a little short version, because I know Drancer wants to get to the beach. He's got a Speedo ready to go. If you're looking for more pod options, Johnny Hockey, Johnny Gaudreau of the Columbus Blue Jackets joins Craig Custance and Sean Gentile on the season finale of the Athletic Hockey Show, Tuesday, Boys USA edition. Johnny Hockey, you know, the suburb of New Jersey, right? Like, just going to Columbus, that should work for him. As for us, this is our only episode of this week. We will have one next week and then take our summer vacation at that point before we launch, just before training camp. So we'd like to thank all of you for listening to this week's edition of the VanCast. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to leave a rating and a review. And right now you can get an annual subscription to The Athletic for just $1 a month for 6 months when you visit theathletic.com/VanCast. And of course, yes, you know, we understand we are going to take some time in August, but whenever there's important news, we'll absolutely have bonus episodes of the show so that you're always going to hear fresh, important Canucks news to comment on. So thanks for listening, and we will talk again next week.